This is the time and place set for oral argument in State of Idaho versus Mark Charles Wilson, docket number 47358. Here on behalf of Mr. Wilson is Ms. Allred. Here on behalf of the state is Mr. Olson. Are the parties prepared to proceed, Ms. Allred?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead, please.
May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Wilson was charged with first degree murder for causing the death of Ms. Brown. He admitted that he killed her. After killing Ms. Brown, he called police to report his actions, was safely taken into custody, and openly participated in all rounds of questioning. Mr. Wilson used a gun in the commission of this offense. At that time, he was already a convicted felon. He was convicted in a separate trial for unlawful possession of a firearm. In the case at hand, the question for the jury was not whether Mr. Brown whether Mr. Wilson killed Ms. Brown, but instead which type of homicide the killing amounted to. The jury was instructed on first degree murder, second degree murder, and voluntary manslaughter. On appeal, Mr. Wilson raised three issues: abuse of discretion for allowing the evidence that he was a convicted felon, excessive sentencing, and a multi-part issue related to the denial of his Rule 35 motion. Unless there are any questions, I will submit the sentencing and the denial of the Rule 35 motion on the briefing. Mr. Wilson asserts the district court abused its discretion in allowing the presentation of evidence that he was a convicted felon. State's Exhibits 16 and 18 show the post-arrest booking and interrogation of Mr. Wilson by Officer May Doyle. These exhibits contained a portion of the conversation in which Mr. Wilson and Officer May Doyle discussed the fact that Mr. Wilson was a convicted felon and was not allowed to possess a gun. The district court's verbal ruling on the admissibility of this evidence is a bit unclear in that it references Idaho Rule of Evidence 609 in addition to Idaho Rule of Evidence 404B. The parties below and on appeal agree that the evidence was not admissible pursuant to Rule 609. As such, today I will focus on 404B, specifically the prejudice prong, as counsel previously conceded that the evidence has some relevance.
Counsel?
Yes.
Just a quick clarifying question. So are you agreeing that 609, not that it's just not admissible under 609, but that 609 is irrelevant to the analysis?
I believe that it is irrelevant to the analysis. The only reason it was discussed in the briefing is because the district court seemed to kind of throw it into its ruling. So we wanted to be sure that we were clear the evidence could not come in under 609. But I think that was articulated by both parties below. And I believe the state's briefing has basically reiterated that lower concession that 609 does not apply. So I do not think that a 609 analysis is necessarily I don't think it plays any role in the decision at all. And we just wanted to make sure we were covering all of our bases.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Wilson asserts that this limited relevance is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. Evidence that a person is convicted felon is undoubtedly prejudicial as it carries a certain stigma. It invites the jury to consider propensity evidence and think of the defendant as a known criminal, a person more likely than the average individual to commit another crime. At the district court hearing, the state recognized the danger in presenting this evidence, noting, "I did not intend on using the fact that he is a felon. I don't want the jury to convict him just because he is a felon." The jury being told he was a convicted felon allowed the jury to evaluate the evidence with propensity in mind and to not limit their consideration to just which type of homicide Mr. Wilson's actions amounted to, but to consider the question, which type of homicide is a convicted felon more likely to commit? The danger of unfair prejudice was high. Mr. Wilson has been labeled indelibly in the minds of the jurors as a felon. Conversely, the evidence had very little probative value. The unfair prejudice from this information substantially outweighed its limited probative value, and as such, the district court abused its discretion by allowing the presentation of this evidence. Unless there are any further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Allred. Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel. The district court acted well within its discretion to admit evidence that Wilson was a felon who was not permitted to possess a firearm. The probative value of this evidence was not substantially outweighed by any danger of unfair prejudice. Now, in order to prove that Wilson committed first-degree murder, the state was required to prove, among other things, that the shooting of Pat Brown was premeditated and was conducted with malice. Now, those are both elements that require the state to prove a state of mind, essentially. What was going on in Wilson's head at the time he killed Pat Brown? And what the state has at its disposal to prove elements like that are the actions of the defendant and the circumstances surrounding those actions. So the manner and circumstances surrounding how Wilson obtained the murder weapon has a very important significance to those elements of the crime. And the fact that Wilson was a felon who was not permitted to possess the weapon was relevant to both premeditation, as Wilson acknowledged below, and also to the question of malice. And the lengths that Wilson was willing to go to conduct another crime was relevant to his state of mind, what his state of mind was in acquiring that weapon and what his plan was for it. If Wilson could have lawfully possessed a weapon, his acquisition of one is simply less suspicious, and it's more likely that his intentions were something less significant than committing a murder. And this is evidence that was also relevant because it was consistent with the other evidence of malice and premeditation, including Wilson's expressed annoyance with Brown that he brought up during the interrogation, the fact that he was having a bad day and things like that. So the fact that he was willing to commit a crime to access this weapon makes it more likely that the state's theory of the case was correct. And also the timing of all of this is very important to the probative value of the evidence as well. If Wilson had acquired this weapon a year earlier, there's just a lot more possibility for reasons why someone might be willing to commit a crime to acquire a weapon in a general sense. But when the murder weapon is acquired right before the murder is committed, the fact that the weapon was acquired unlawfully is even more relevant to his state of mind at that time. And weighed against this relevance, the danger of unfair prejudice was limited. And I think one of the reasons that the danger of unfair prejudice was limited was because the district courts took care to limit that risk. And the court limited that risk by rejecting the state's request to delve more into the circumstances of that underlying felony. And if the court didn't do that, I think we'd have an entirely different question on appeal, a much more complicated question, as there would be considerably more risk for unfair prejudice considering the circumstances of that underlying felony, which was another violent crime. But instead, the district court reasonably exercised its discretion in drawing that line of admissibility where it did. And also Wilson's statement about his status as a felon came up only very briefly in the context of that lengthy police interview where Wilson admitted to killing Brown. So whatever the risk of unfair prejudice was, it certainly was not substantially outweighed, it did not substantially outweigh the probative value. And the district court did not abuse its discretion. I wanted to touch on harmless error very briefly because the clarification of the harmless error standard has come up in this case and a couple other cases. And the Idaho Supreme Court has recently clarified the harmless error standard, but the strength of evidence presented at trial and the description of it as overwhelming is still a fair thing to do. It's still a very important consideration in that analysis. And overwhelming evidence is a term that's commonly used by this court and the Idaho Supreme Court in analyzing harmless error. What Garcia, the Idaho Supreme Court case, warned us against was simply an over-reliance on the overwhelming evidence standard. An overwhelming evidence standard that had been utilized in California prior to Chapman v. California, which I didn't dig back any further than that, but I suppose that was a standard where they just look at the strength of the evidence and that was it. And we know it's more of a two-factor test, a consideration of both the probative force of the record establishing guilt and the probative force of the error, which is just a consideration of how much the error mattered. How compelling was the evidence that was admitted in error? But I would suggest in a 403 harmless error analysis, the strength of the state's case is of particularly more significant than it might be in another harmless error case. Because in a 403 case, we kind of already have an analysis of the probative value of, or the probative force of the error. We discussed the probative force of the error in the context of whether the danger of unfair prejudice outweighed the probative value of the evidence. So in a 403 test, we've already considered the probative force. And so the evidence, the other evidence that the state brought to the table is of particular importance. But regardless of that, the state did, contrary to, I guess the assertion in the reply brief, did not discuss only the probative force of the record establishing guilt, but also the very limited probative force of any error, in that the evidence, while relevant, was not the only evidence of premeditation. And also the reference to Wilson's felony conviction, as I noted, was brief, and it was not relied upon by the state at closing argument. So it really was not an integral part of the trial. So even applying that appropriate harmless error test, yes.
So I have a question for you based on sort of the analysis that you've just given us. Is the state arguing that the 403 analysis is essentially the harmless error analysis?
Your Honor, they can say it is not the same analysis because they have different functions, and the 403 test is a weighing test against probative value of that same evidence, whereas the probative force of the error portion of the harmless error test is not weighed against just that evidence. It's weighed against all of the evidence at the trial. So I would say they're different tests in that sense, where 403, you're weighing it against the evidence itself. And with harmless error, you're weighing it against all of the state's evidence that was presented at trial. But as far as the types of things you're talking about, as far as I can tell, it is exactly the same. What we're looking at is basically, we're looking at the evidence that should not have been admitted, and how compelling was it? What was the risk that it was going to influence the jury and contribute to the verdict? So I've thought a lot about this. I believe that part of the analysis is the same. We're talking about the same things. The only difference is, one, we're discussing it solely in the context of the evidence itself, and in the other, we're comparing it against all of the other state's evidence. And that's why if you get to harmless error in any case, the nature of this other evidence is so important, because it's the new thing you're throwing into the mix in a harmless error analysis that is not a part of 403. So to describe evidence as overwhelming is a fair thing to do. I think that's getting a little pushback right now, but it's a critical part of a 403 analysis, and really a harmless error analysis as well.
So if a piece of evidence under a 403 analysis, if the probative value outweighs the prejudice as just for that piece of evidence, and in a harmless error analysis, you're adding even more pieces of evidence to that analysis. I'm trying to think about how, if the specific piece of evidence is not unduly prejudicial when weighed against itself, how it could be unduly prejudicial when weighed against even more evidence in the aggregate.
I think, Your Honor, it could not be, because if the 403 evidence stands up to that comparison with itself, if the probative value of the evidence outweighs the risk of unfair prejudice, or is not substantially outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice, then the evidence is not precluded by 403, and no harmless error analysis is required. So I think the only way that we're getting to harmless error is if this court finds that, and in any case, this or any case, the only way we're getting to Garcia and the clarified harmless error test is if the danger of unfair prejudice substantially outweighs the probative value of that same evidence. And if that happens, now the case isn't vacated immediately. Now the state has the opportunity to show what the other evidence was and whether that overcomes that error in that sense. So I would suggest that that is correct. Certainly, if the state passes the 403 test, it would easily pass the harmless error test if it needed to, but it wouldn't need to because it wasn't an error.
Thank you.
And unless there's any other questions on that, the state would submit on the brief on the remaining issues that opposing counsel did, and respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of conviction in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Ms. Allred, any reply?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I want to touch on a few things. I want to first briefly talk about the relevance of this evidence. Of course, I am constrained to say that it has limited relevance. What we're talking about here really is the state does have a burden to prove premeditation and malice. And it is our position that the fact that Mr. Wilson is a convicted felon does very little to assist that. What we have in this case is an individual who did go that same day and borrow a gun from a neighbor, bring it to the home, move it around the home for reasons that myself and the state disagree on. They believe it was to hide the weapon from Ms. Brown. And then later that same day, kill Ms. Brown. The fact that he's a convicted felon borrowing the gun does little to add to that. The state still gets to show all of this evidence that he obtained the gun that day. I would guarantee that in a state of in a different case where we were charging premeditated murder, the fact that a person already had a gun would not in any way lessen the significance of the analysis to whether or not that crime was premeditated. This isn't a person who went and, you know, had to do a masterful plan to purchase this illegal weapon. He simply went across the street to a neighbor and borrowed a gun. We're in Challis, Idaho. Guns are very prevalent. People do use guns to, as Mr. Wilson claimed, put down, you know, a cat that was sick. So just none of that, I think, really, the felon status changes what the state can prove with their premeditation argument with the other other evidence that is presented.
Counsel, on that point, you're talking about the fact of the convicted felon, but are we just talking about the fact of being a convicted felon? Or are we talking about the convicted felon precludes him from having a firearm?
I think that's a difficult question. I certainly think that the parties, the state certainly argued that they wanted to keep out the the information that he could not possess a weapon. Defense counsel really focused on, I believe this, that he was a convicted felon. Certainly there are no good reasons that a person can't possess a gun. There is nothing that you would want the jury to know as to why you couldn't possess a gun. But I think right now we're really talking about the felon. I think it is more ambiguous with a reason he can't possess the gun. The felon, the status as a felon is more damning, but I do think that there's limited relevance to him not being able to possess a gun either.
So is your position that the jury could hear evidence that he was legally prohibited from possessing a weapon, but they just couldn't hear evidence that the reason for that prohibition was his felon status?
No, I think on remand, if we are successful, that this court should prohibit both of that evidence. But I do think that our argument has to be focused on the status as a felon based on the way that counsel's arguments were presented below. So for our purposes on appeal, we are presenting the felon. I think the rest of that kind of flows from that. You know, the state didn't present any way to edit this audio recording where it wouldn't be that he was a felon to get that information out. They were not allowed to talk about the nature of his prior conviction. So I'm not sure how the state would get this evidence in without knowing that he is a felon. But I do think that if there is a way, possibly that's something that they can relitigate below. But I do think they follow very closely together, that they are kind of one and the same.
Thank you.
The state below, again, I would like to reiterate, thought that his status as a convicted felon was not relevant. We kind of have an interesting history in this case where the state wants to present the information of his conviction. There is a hearing on that, and the district court says, for mediation purposes, I'll probably allow that evidence. The parties go to mediation months later. The issue comes up again, and at this point, the district court says, I don't think it is relevant. I'm not going to allow it. There is some litigation after that, and defense counsel files this motion to prohibit the use of the word felon. And then there is another hearing, at which point then the district court kind of changes their mind, and we see this kind of mixed ruling with 609 and ultimately finds, and that's at that point makes the statement that it is relevant, and defense counsel agrees that it is limitedly relevant, but still adamantly argues that the prejudicial effect outweighs any probative value. The state also discussed that this was very brief in the trial. Certainly when you look at the trial as a whole, this is not a significant amount of time, but in these exhibits, it is not necessarily brief. In State's Exhibit 16, which is the officer's body cam, that exhibit is about 20 minutes. And this conversation about the gun felony is under a minute, but around, 45 seconds of that time. So that's not an especially brief amount. It's not 1 second in a 20 minute video. The other video is significantly longer, about 2 hours. I don't know that any of that, in kind of my quick review again this morning, I don't see that specifically being played for the jury. It is very cumulative. They certainly were given that exhibit. A large majority of that exhibit is just video of him sitting in the room and then events that occurred after Mr. Wilson had even left the premises. So while it is small in that video, that is because probably about at least an hour and a half of that video is largely irrelevant. I want to turn now to the harmless error argument. We have asserted that this error is harmless, but also that the state has failed to meet its burden. Garcia clarified the harmless error test, as this court is well aware, and the state was well aware in presenting their briefing, noting, citing Garcia, and noting that they needed to consider the probative force of the error. However, other than that citation, there is no argument regarding the probative force of the error. It is completely devoid of any mention of the weighing that is required. And as such, we believe that they failed to meet their burden to prove that the error was harmless, and failed, honestly, to even fully assert that the error was harmless. This is clearly a two-part test, and simply mentioning overwhelming evidence is not enough. Now, it didn't require the state to do much more. They could have even possibly just contained a sentence that said the probative force of the record as a whole, outweighs the probative force of the error. But they did not make that argument in any way. If the state wanted to rely on its 403 argument in asserting the weighing, they should have referenced back to it or made that clear. But instead, what we're left with is a record where the state did not meet its burden. So based on that, if this court does find that the evidence is outweighed by the 403 balancing, we assert that this court must then find that the error is not harmless, because under State versus Almarez, the state failed to properly assert the error was harmless. If there are no further questions, I just ask this court to vacate Mr. Wilson's judgment of conviction and remand his case for a new trial in which evidence of his prior felony conviction is excluded.
Thank you, Ms. Allred. The court appreciates the briefing and argument in this case. The case is now fully submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. The court will be in recess until 10:30 a.m.
Thank you.
Thank you.